Okay, get them off. Jonathan, I don't think this even says it on the catalog out here. Can you go online? You can go online. You can order one from there.
Yeah, Amazon.com has all that stuff on it.
Amazon.com. Is that in Reflections on Kindle?
I really don't have it yet.
They're still not putting it out on the Kindle.
I wonder if they got one of the Chromebook. You know, Chromebook has it.
All right, let's go ahead and start. We're going to start on Bill's story, and that's page one. And I want you to remember that the first two chapters is to convince us of one thing. The first two chapters is to convince us what is the problem, step one. And now that we've read Silkworth to explain the problem from the medical perspective, now we're going to have a textbook example of a person who is afflicted with the very condition the doctor describes in the doctor's opinion. The purpose being that hopefully I can identify, you can identify, we can identify with Bill's experience. As we go through Bill's story, we'll see where Bill exhibits the obsession of the mind, then where he exhibits the physical allergy, and we'll also see the progression of alcoholism and where it leads. And through pages 1 through 8, let's see if we can relate to Bill's drinking experience at all. Bill's story. War fever ran high in the New England town to which we were new young officers from Plattsburgh were assigned, and we were flattered when the first citizens took us to their home, making us feel heroic. Here was love, applause, war, moments sublime with intervals hilarious. I was part of life at last, and in the midst of the excitement, I discovered liquor. I forgot the strong warnings and the prejudice of my people, his family, concerning drink. In time we sailed for over there, that was England, I was very lonely and again turned to alcohol. And he went to a Winchester Cathedral in England. And he, you know, if you've ever seen it, it is a magnificent place. And outside it, and I've got a friend who sends out a daily talk down in South Florida, a guy named Tom, and I got a picture of him recently where he was over there visiting, and he's standing next to this tombstone. And it says, "Here lies a Hampshire grenadier who caught his death drinking cold small beer. A good soldier is never forgot whether he died by musket or by pot." And Bill says it's an ominous warning which I failed to heed. And, you know, they're over there. Bill's feeling great. He's in a leadership position. He's an officer. And he figured that when he got back home, he was going to be a leader. He was going to be on top of the world. And so he took a page two, I took a night law course and obtained employment as an investigator for a surety company. The drive for success was on. I would prove to the world I was important. I would prove to the world I was important. Now, is that an ego statement? That's an ego. My work took me about Wall Street, and little by little I've been interested in the market. Many people lost money, but some became very rich. Why not I? So I studied economics and business as well as law. Potential alcoholic that I was, he was 22 years old, potential alcoholic that I was, I nearly failed my law course. At one of the finals, I was too drunk to think or write. Though my drinking was not yet continuous, it disturbed my wife. We had long talks where I would still her foreboding by telling her that men of genius conceive their best projects when drunk. Okay. Yeah, right. That the most majestic construction of philosophy thoughts were so derived by people being intoxicated. Yeah, that really helped Lois a lot. You know, Lois spent 5 years trying to help Bill get sober and stay sober. And it Lois couldn't do it. Frothy emotional appeal couldn't do it. She couldn't do it. I don't know how many of you know how important it is. I'm in the South. I'm in South Alabama right now. I know you all know how important it is when you write in the family Bible. You know, you write births, you write deaths, you write marriages, things like that. But if you write a solemn pledge never to drink again in the family Bible and put your hand on that Bible, I know that religious people say, that's it. He will never drink again. Bill did that twice. Bill did that twice. And that's somebody who I would think was an alcoholic. By the time I completed the course, I knew that the law was not for me. He never was a lawyer. He completed and got a law degree, and he wrote like a lawyer in this book. He did not write like an eighth grade school teacher, which I'd like to tell you that's as far as I ever got. Well, I really don't like to tell you that. I just tell you that's as far as I ever got. So some of these words, like I did a minute ago, I have to just go with what I know, not what's there, because I can't read quite as good as Bill can write. But after he got a law degree, he thought it wasn't for him. He really thought Wall Street was the way to do it, and business financial leaders were his heroes. Out of the alley of drink and speculation, I commenced to forge the weapon that one day would turn in its flight like a boomerang and all but cut me to ribbons. Living modestly, my wife and I saved $1,000. It went into certain securities, then cheap, rather unpopular. I rightly imagined they would someday have a great rise. I failed to persuade my broker friends to send me out looking over factories and management, but my wife and I decided to go anyway. I had developed a theory that most people lost money in stocks through ignorance of market, and I discovered many more reasons later on. So we gave up our position, we rode off on a motorcycle. I don't know if you've ever seen pictures of the little sidecar and the tent that Bill and Lois drove around to these different factories, and he would go and he would meet the factory workers, and he would go drink with them, and he would find out what we now call insider information. And that's why when they talk about in the book, they talk about stock broker. Bill was a stock broker. He was not a stock broker. He was a stock speculator, which is an entirely different thing. A stock broker is somebody else, and a stock speculator is somebody who gets inside information, goes and tries to buy up the stock, waiting for this takeover to happen or waiting for something else to happen that's going to improve the stock. And that's what Bill was doing. By the way, that's against the law now. Apparently it wasn't back when he was doing it. They drove around. They had a lot of success. And remember, he was still a potential alcoholic. We covered this on page 3. We covered the whole eastern United States in a year, and at the end of it, my reports to Wall Street procured me a position there and the use of a large expense account. The exercise of an option brought in more money, leaving us a profit of $7,000 for that year. For the next few years, fortune threw money and applause my way. I had arrived. All right? My judgment and ideas were followed by many to the tune of paper millions. The great boom of the late 20s was seething and swelling. Drink was taking an important and exhilarating part in my life. There was loud talk in the jazz places uptown. Everybody spent in thousands and chattered in millions. Scoffers could scoff and be damned. I made a host of fair-weather friends. Fair-weather friends. You might want to underline that, because they're not there when you quit drinking. My drinking assumed more serious, and this is where he's starting to get the progression. My drinking assumed more serious proportions, continuing all day and almost every night. The remonstrances of my friends terminated in a row, and I became a lone wolf. He isolated and drank. He didn't have any friends, you know, because every time he got drunk, he got in a fight, and he just ran all his friends off. So he became what they call a lone wolf drinker. And there's many of us out there. We isolate, and we're not hurting anybody, we say. And there's the statistic somewhere, I don't know where it is, that every time that I say I don't hurt anybody but myself, the average people that we hurt are 25. Our family and our friends, co-workers, people we run into, police officers, things like that. So when I'm telling myself I'm drinking, I'm just hurting myself, that's a lie. There are approximately 25 other people. With me, there were more than 25, but that's about the average. Okay, he's drinking every night. He's a lone wolf drinker. There were many unhappy scenes in our sumptuous apartment. There had been no real infidelity, for loyalty to my wife, helped at times by extreme drunkenness, kept me out of those scrapes. Okay, Bill says there was no real infidelity, and Bill writes a book called As Bill Sees It. Lois writes a book as Lois remembers it. and they don't actually correspond on that infidelity between the two books. But that's as far as I'm going to go with talking about that. In 1929, he contracted Gal Fever. He went at once to the country club, to the country. My wife to applaud while I started out to overtake Walter Hagen, a great golfer. Liquor caught up with me much faster than I came up behind Walter. I began to be jittery in the morning. Golf permitted drinking every day and every night. And it was fun to cram around at the exclusive course which had inspired such awe in me as a lad. I acquired an impeccable coat of tan one sees upon the well-to-do. The local banker watched me whirl fat checks in and out of the till with amused skepticism. All right, now, he's drinking an awful lot, but he's having the time of his life. He's making a ton of money, and he's having the time of his life until this next paragraph. Abruptly, in October of 1929, hell broke loose on the New York Stock Exchange. After one of those days of inferno, I wobbled from a hotel bar to a brokerage office. It was 8 o'clock, 5 hours after the market closed. The ticker still clattered. I was staring at an inch of tape which bore the inscription XYZ32. It had been at 52 that morning. And I was finished, and so were many of his friends. The papers reported men were jumping to their desks from the towers of the high finance. That disgusted Bill. He would not jump. He went back to the bar instead of jumping. My friends had dropped $7 million since 10 o'clock this morning. So what? Tomorrow was another day. As I drank, the old fierce determination to win came back. Now, everybody's millions of dollars of paper money had just been lost by these people. And he's back at the bar saying, so what? Tomorrow's another day. I'm just going to drink, and I'm going to get more determined than ever. And so he did a geographic change. The next morning, I telephoned a friend in Montreal. He had plenty of money left, and I thought I'd better go to Canada. I wonder why he wanted to get out of New York when hundreds of his friends had invested millions of their dollars in his stock little ideas. And by the following spring, we were living in our accustomed style. I had felt like Napoleon returning to Evelyn. No St. Helena for me. But drinking caught up with me again, and my generous friend had to let me go. This time we stayed broke. We went to live with my parents. I found a job, then lost it as a result of a brawl with a taxi driver. Mercilessly, no one could guess that I was to have no real employment for the next 5 years, or hardly draw a sober breath. My wife began to work in a department store, coming home exhausted to find me drunk, and I became an unwelcome hanger-on at the brokerage places. Liquor ceased to be a luxury. Right? He's crossed the line. It became a necessity. Bathtub gin, remember the time right about then, it was a prohibition, so bathtub gin was around. 2 bottles a day and often 3 got to be a routine. 3 bottles of gin a day, it seems like an awful lot of alcohol to be drinking at me. You know, but I guess Bill could handle it. Sometimes he'd make a small deal and net a few $100s, and he'd pay his bills at the bars and delicatessens. And this went on endlessly, and I began to waken very early in the morning, shaking violently. You know, a tumbler full of gin followed by a half a dozen bottles of beer would be required if I was to eat breakfast. Now, you know, you wake up and you're going to eat breakfast, and you're going to have a tumbler of gin and a half a six-pack, or a six-pack. I'm thinking that you got a problem. I still thought I could control the situation. There were periods of sobriety which renewed my wife's hope. He would stop every now and then. He would drink until he couldn't drink anymore. He would stop for a short period of time. And then the next paragraph, it says, gradually things got worse. The house was taken over by the mortgage holder. My mother-in-law died. My wife and my father-in-law became ill. All right? Then I got a promising business opportunity. Stocks were at their lower point of 1932, and I had somehow managed to form a group to buy. I was to share generously in the profits. Then I went on a prodigious bender, and the chance vanished. Now he has it all set up. He has all these people ready to invest in him. They're believing in him again, and he gets drunk. And the chance to make all this money vanishes. And it says, I woke up. I've got in my little notes, came to. This had to be stopped. I saw I could not so much as take one drink. I was through forever. Before then, I'd written lots of sweet promises, but my wife happily observed, this time I meant business, and so did I. And you can write next to that, self-will avails us nothing, because that's exactly what he's saying. By myself, I am going to stop doing this. He's wrote those promises in the Bible. Lois is believing. She wanted to believe so bad. You know?
You probably wasn't lying at that time, at that exact moment.
At that exact moment. And shortly afterward, I came home drunk. You know? There had been no fight. Where had been his high resolve? I simply didn't know. It didn't even come to mind. Somebody had pushed a drink my way, and I had taken it. Was I crazy? I began to wonder, for such an appalling lack of perspective seemed near being just that. Renewing my resolve, I tried again. For some time past, confidence began to be replaced by cocksuredness. I could laugh at the gin mills. Now I had what it takes. One day I walked into a cafe to telephone somebody. In no time I was beating on the bar, asking myself how it happened. As the whiskey rose to my head, I told myself I would manage better the next time. But I might as well get good and drunk then. And I did. So, you know, he walks into this bar. He's got no interest in alcohol. He's laughing cockily at the gin mills. And he walks in there, and in no time at all, he's beating at the bar saying, what the hell happened? You know? The remorse... This is a great paragraph here, because... It talks about a bottom. It talks about a bottom, and you would think this is it. The remorse, horror, and hopelessness of the next morning are unforgettable. I'm going to read that again. The remorse, horror, and hopelessness of the next morning are unforgettable. The courage to do battle was not there. My brain raced uncontrollably, and there was a terrible sense of impending calamity. I hardly dare cross the street, lest I collapse and be run down by an early morning truck, for it was scarcely daylight. All night place supplied me with a dozen glasses of ale. My withering nerves were stilled at last. A morning paper told me the market had gone to hell again. Well, so had I. The market would recover, but I wouldn't. That was a hard thought. Should I kill myself? Nope, not now. Then a mental fog settled down. Mental fog is described as depression. Okay? And so he got depressed. At the beginning of that paragraph, remorse, horror, and hopelessness were unforgettable. By the end of that paragraph, gin would fix that, so two bottles and off to oblivion. You know, so in the same paragraph, he has hit a bottom. And by the end of the paragraph, he is drinking again. And he goes on to say that the mind and the body are marvelous mechanisms, for mind endured this agony 2 more years. Morning, noon, and night, he drank for 2 more years. After swearing off, after laughing at the gin mills, after knowing that he was never going to drink again based on self-will, he spent another 2 years drinking. Sometimes I stole from my wife's cylinder purse when the morning terror and madness were on me. Again, I swayed dizzily before the open window or the medicine cabinet where there was cursing myself for a weakling, for being a weakling. He was chicken to throw himself out a window. That's why he was cursing. And he was too chicken to take the poison that was in the medicine cabinet to just commit suicide quickly. He was killing himself slowly. Mm-hmm. And many people do. Many people do. There were flights from the city to the country, geographical change, and back, as my wife and I sought escape. Then came the night when the physical and mental torture was so hellish, I fear I would burst through my window, sash and all. Somehow I managed to drag my mattress to the lower floor, lest I suddenly leap. All right, now, here's something real important. Because it's in both Bill's story and Dr. Bob's story. All right? And it's called dual addiction. We have a singleness of purpose in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we have stayed and survived because of that singleness of purpose. But don't let anybody tell you that they won't, both our co-founders weren't dual addicted. Because it says right there, a doctor came with a heavy sedative. The next day found me drinking both gin and sedative. This combination soon landed me on the rocks. Okay? Dr. Bob, If you read his book, he talks about drinking and then to steady his nerves in the morning to do his proctology operation, he had to take sedatives. If I ever have to have an operation, I want that doctor not to be jittery. You know what I mean?
Okay.
There's a part of me that does not want anybody with a sharp instrument to be jittery around, and that's a region right there. People feared for my sanity, so did I. I could eat little or nothing when drinking, and I was 40 pounds underweight. We see so many people come into Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and they're just skin and bones. And what it is the body stops wanting to metabolize food that we eat. We might eat, but our body doesn't want to metabolize it. It wants to metabolize the sugar that's in the alcohol. And it's become so good at doing that that the body would rather drink than eat. And that's why we see so many people, when they first come in, looking horribly thin. And we're the only group of people that the worse you look like when you come in, the more we love you. You know, because you're probably right at that point. You're probably right at that jumping off point if you look miserable when you come in. It's keeping you in. That's what we need to do. We need to keep you in. And that's what we're trying to do. Because I want to say that his brother-in-law is a physician, and through his kindness and that of his mother, he was placed in a nationally known hospital for the mental and physical rehabilitation of alcoholics. It's Towns Hospital. Under the so-called Belladonna treatment, Belladonna comes from the angel trumpet plant, and that's what they used to give alcoholics to taper them off. It's similar to methadone being given to a heroin addict. It tapers them down to where they can then get off the methadone. Well, that's what they thought back in 1934. They thought that belladonna and all these other things that they were trying would clear his brain. Under the so-called belladonna treatment, my brain cleared. Hydrotherapy and mild exercise helped much. Best of all, I met a kind doctor who explained that though certainly selfish and foolish, he's telling Bill he's certainly selfish and foolish, that he had been seriously ill, both bodily and mentally. Bodily, the allergy, mentally, the obsession. It relieved me to somewhat learn that in alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor. It's going to tell us later on in the book that it's going to go away. You know, we're trying to fight liquor when we first come in here. We are trying not to drink one day at a time. But in doing these steps in order, in applying these principles in our life, we'll read in about page 84 or 87, somewhere up there, where the thought of drinking has just been removed. It just goes away. All right? It relieved me someone learned that alcoholics will... My incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. Understanding myself now, I fared forth in high hope. For 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high. He was sober. He went to town regularly and even made a little money. Surely this was the answer. Self-knowledge. Okay, we started off a minute ago self-will. Now it's self-knowledge. I can cure myself. I can sponsor myself through this program. I drank for 3.5 years sponsoring myself. So self-knowledge gains us nothing. But it was not, for the frightful day came when I drank once more. One drink. The curve of my declining moral and bodily health fell off like a ski jump. After a time, I returned to the hospital. This was the finish, the curtain, it seemed to me. My weary and despairing wife was informed that it would all end in heart failure during delirious tremors, or I would develop a wet brain, perhaps within a year, psychosis. She would soon have to give me over to the undertaker or the asylum. I don't know how many of you all have ever been to an asylum. I don't know how many of you ever have seen a person who has a wet brain. But let me tell you something. It's a really sad sight. The best I can describe it is in the movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Jack Nicholson winds up having a frontal lobotomy, and he just walks around not knowing he's even walking around, and that's what a wet brain looks like. And it's horrible. They did not need to tell me. I knew and almost welcomed the idea. It was a devastating blow. We're going to the top of page 8. To my pride, I who had thought so well of myself and my abilities and my capacity to surmount obstacles was cornered at last. Now I was to plunge into the dark, joining the endless procession of sots who had gone on before me. I thought of my poor wife. There had been much happiness, after all. What would I not give to make amends? But that was over now. No words, and here it is. And this is really, you know, when you read this, if you can't associate with it, you might not be done. No words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched all around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. You might want to underline master, because it was for me. Now, this is his second visit. And once he got sobered up, you know, it says, trembling, I stepped from the hospital a broken man. Fear sobered me for a bit. Fear sobered him for a bit. It didn't keep him sober. He was afraid to get drunk because he knew he was going to get the wet brain, but that only lasted a short period of time. Because then came the insidious insanity of that first drink, and that's what we're going to learn about step two, is the insanity before the first drink. What we're thinking before we take that first drink. And on Armistice Day 1934, I was off again. Everyone became resigned to the certainty that I would have to be shut up somewhere or would stumble along to a miserable end. How dark it is before the dawn. How true that statement is. How dark it is before the dawn. In reality, that was the beginning of his last debauch. I was soon to be catapulted, that's a promise there, into what I like to call the fourth dimension of existence. I was to know happiness, peace, and usefulness in a way of life that is incredibly more wonderful as time passes. Now, up to this point, I hope everyone in this room has been able to say, okay, yeah, I've felt that. I've felt that way more than once. You know, because if you can't relate to what's going on in Bill's story, it's going to be hard to relate to anything else coming up. So if you haven't had the despair, if you haven't had the loneliness, if you haven't had the heartaches, and I'm looking around here and I'm saying to myself, yep, everybody here has been there, you know, what are we going to do about it? Up to this point, I'm going to stop and go to some of my notes and just go over some of the things we've gone up to page 8. On page 1, it talks about Bill drinks when times are good and when times are bad. On page 2, it says drinking was not yet continuous. He was a potential alcoholic. And that was in 1921. In 1921, he was a potential alcoholic. Okay? He becomes an inside trader, a visionary. On page 3, it starts with more serious proportions, continuing all day and night, hard drinking. And that's in 1926. That's the progression started for him. Things start to go bad for Bill. Social problems, marital problems, and the onset of withdrawal symptoms, the jitteriness in the morning. On page 4, he talks about his determination, you know. And then the progression where the job problems, the financial problems, he loses his jobs, and it just boomerangs on him. Throw a little history piece out here. Bill Wilson was the first person to actually carve and make a boomerang in the United States of America. He did it out of the base or the headboard of one of the old beds at his house, and he tried many times to make a boomerang, and eventually one day he was able to make it work and come all the way back around, and it almost killed his grandfather. But that's why he used the word boomerang, and I just thought a little history wouldn't hurt there. On page 5, he's in full alcoholism. He's crossed the line. No longer a potential alcoholic, no longer a hard drinking. In page 5, it says, see the doctor's opinion. Bottom of page 5, he realizes he can't drink safely. I was through forever. This time he means business. This time he's using willpower. And 1930, in Lois's diary, she's been trying for 5 years to help him get over his drinking problem. And he wants to know where has been his high resolve. He can't explain it to himself why he drinks. I couldn't explain it to myself why I picked up that drink that last time. There was just no reason at all, other than I looked back and I realized I had not done anything for my recovery. I had not done anything in this program. I had stopped drinking for 9 months. I had gone to meetings every day. I had prayed every day. I had not done one step. I was lying to people in the room by telling them I had a sponsor. I was sponsoring myself. They'd ask me what step I was on. I was always on step four. It didn't matter what month it was. I was still on step four. You know, I was a liar, a cheater, and a thief. And I picked up a drink because I didn't ever do anything for my problem. And my problem wasn't alcohol. It'll tell me later on, the problem centers in my mind. It's already said it once. My problem centers in my mind. You know, he's grinding away with his resolve. He doesn't understand the nature of his illness yet, and that on his own he's powerless. He has an obsession, and then he's off to the races again. Bottom of page 6, they talk about weak-willed. Like I said a minute ago, you know, alcoholics and drug addicts are not weak-willed people. We will move mountains to get that drink when we want that drink. You know, when somebody says, well, it's a bad storm out tonight, I'm not going to a meeting, I always laugh and said, did you ever go drinking in a bad storm? And people will say, yeah, I drove drunk in a bad storm. So, you know, why wouldn't you go to a meeting and try to help somebody? Because just being in a meeting sometimes will help somebody. I can attest to the fact that just being in a meeting is doing 12-step work. Not everybody sponsors people. But being in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous is an actual form of 12-step work. Making the coffee is service work. But sitting in the chair day after day, week after week, staying sober, working this program, going to meetings, and being there when that newcomer comes in the first day, and then he comes in a second day, and you're still there. And he comes in the third day, and you're still there. And he's looking at you, and he's not saying anything, but he's like, man, that person is here every day. They must be as sick as me. And then you got Margaret over here with 45 years sitting here today, and, you know, she's here at a meeting. She's doing 12-step work. So we are not weak-willed. We will do what we can to get our drink. He's trying to escape. He's not jumping because he wants to. He has to know how bad it's getting because he's thinking about jumping. That's why he moves the bed downstairs. Now, he's gone to page 7. He's in Towns Hospital. He does the belladonna treatment. And it says that he really didn't hit his bottom until we read that part, where the doctor came over with a heavy sedative and the next day found me drinking both gin and sedative, and that combination soon landed me on the rocks. Now that talks about his bottom right there. In step one, Silkworth is given Silkworth's telling Bill the problem. That's step one. And what we'll see, and I can know everything about my illness. In fact, I can't drink safely. I know the consequences that's going to happen, but somehow that wasn't enough to keep me from drinking because I still had the obsession in my mind. I had never been relieved of that obsession. I had stopped drinking for that long period of time. I thought 9 months was a long period of time. For me, it was. But I never got over the obsession. And that next morning after I picked up a 9-month chip, I went and bought a half gallon of whiskey and I was off to the races. Because I still had that obsession. I still had that obsession, and once I put that first drink in me, I don't know what's going to happen. The bottom of page 7, Bill feels that self-knowledge is enough. Man, you know, self-knowledge will kill you. And then at Bill's bottom, you know, every alcoholic understands that feeling of the pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Now, Bill has taken step one right there. You know, he is hopeless. He wants to stop, but he doesn't know how. And, you know, there are people who say, you know, relapse of, you know, is part of the program. It's not. But, you know, we ought to cut some of them a slack. I do, because I was a chronic relapser for 3.5 years. I had not hit my bottom until that morning when I knew that it was over for me. And Bob, after Bill talked with him for those hours, Bob relapsed. He didn't stay sober at their first meeting. It was not until June 10th that he had his last drink. In the middle of page 8, we just described insanity. Less insane or less whole, okay? And it's going to come up at page 38, 40, 92, and 150. Dr. Silkworth calls it obsession. Bill calls it the insanity. They mean the same thing. My insanity, my obsession, was the thought that I could pick up a bottle after 9 months and take a drink. And I'm a chronic alcoholic. There's no way I could take a drink. So we're going to Bill's going to keep referring to it as insanity, and then it'll tell us that finally sanity will return on page 85. I think we're going to do that. There are certain things that I have to do. And what I had to do is I had to let go of the thought that self-will or self-knowledge could help me in any way. I fought the emotional peel. That couldn't keep me sober. Human power, fear, couldn't keep me sober. So, nothing in my life and nothing of this world could keep me sober. And we're going to find out what I do keep sober and stay sober here in a few minutes. Or maybe we won't find that out now. We might find that out next week. Okay, and I usually stop right about here, but I'm not, because I'm ahead of myself. I'm going to go on to where Ebby comes over. Near the end of the bleak November, I sat drinking in my kitchen. With certain satisfaction, I reflected there was enough gin concealed about my house to carry me through the night and the next day. He had hidden enough gin around his house to carry him through a couple days. My wife was at work. I wondered whether I dare hide a full bottle of gin near the head of our bed. I would need it before daylight. My musings were interrupted by the telephone, the cheery voice of an old school friend asked if he might come over. He was sober, and this was somebody who Bill drank with for years. They drank so much one time they took a plane trip. They landed in a little airplane at the grand opening of an airport up in, I think, Rochester or somewhere up there. They were both plastered, and they landed the plane safely on this runway with the mayor and the whole town there, and they all came running over to give them great hugs and welcome to be the first airplane to land. And Bill and Ebby just tumbled out of the plane onto the ground, drunk, you know. And there was a lot of apologies that had to be made after that. But Ebby was a real drunk, and I told you last week in the history that he had driven a car to somebody's house, and he was getting ready to be sentenced to jail when Rowan Hazard, who had come back from Dr. Young and been given the word that every now and then people with chronic alcoholism have recovered by a spiritual remedy. And he had joined the Oxford group. And another man was in the Oxford group, which was the predecessor to Alcoholics Anonymous, named Shep. And they went before the judge. I think the judge was Shep's uncle or something. And they asked if Ebby could be put in their care, in the Oxford group's care. And the judge said yes, and Ebby got sober. Now, Ebby's learned from the Oxford group that one of the ways that he's got to stay sober is he's got to carry the message of sobriety to somebody else. And so he thinks about Bill, and he calls him up, and he says, you know, can I come over? And it was years since I could remember his coming to New York in that condition, sober. I was amazed. Rumor had it he'd been committed for alcoholic insanity. I wondered how he had escaped. He thought he was already in the insane asylum. Of course, he'd have dinner, and then we could drink openly. Then I could drink openly with him. Unmindful of his welfare, I thought only of recapturing the spirit of other days. He wanted some joy again. There was no joy in Bill's life now. I thought only of recapturing the spirit of other days. There was that time that we had chartered an airplane to complete a jag. He was coming. His coming was an oasis in this dreary desert of futility. That airplane was the was a trip when you read some of the history. The very thing in Oasis, drinkers are like that. He thought he had a drinking buddy coming over, somebody who drank like him, you know. And the door opened and he stood there, fresh skinned and glowing. There was something about his eyes. He was inexplicit. He was different. He was really different. And what had happened? Now, that paragraph right there means so much. Because Evie hasn't said a word. Evie hasn't said one word yet to Bill. And Bill sees there's something different about him. He sees this fresh skin. There was something about his eyes. He was really different. What had happened? He pushed a drink across the table. Evie refused it. Disappointed but curious, I wondered what had gotten into this fellow. It wasn't himself. Come on, what's this all about? I queried. He looked straight at me, simply but smilingly. He said, I've got religion. Okay? And that's what Evie said, because that's what the Oxford group was. It was a religious program. And Bill said, I was a gas. So that was it. Last summer, an alcoholic crackpot, now I suspected a little cracked about religion. He had that starry-eyed look. Yes, the old boy was on fire, all right. Bless his heart, let him rant. Besides, my gin would last longer than his preaching. And it did. But he did no ranting. Ebby did no ranting. In a matter-of-fact way, he told how two men had appeared in court persuading the judge to suspend his commitment, that told him of this simple religious idea, step three, and a practical program of action, which became steps 4 through 9 for us. That was 2 months ago, and the result was self-evident. It worked. He'd come to pass his experience on to me, and if I cared to have it. I was shocked but interested. Certainly I was interested. I had to be, for I was hopeless. Okay? And skipping down, Ebby's talking about, you know, through the next paragraph about the preachers and tell him he's got to listen, and he just didn't want to hear it. But he goes on to say, I had always believed in a power greater than myself. I had often pondered these things. I was not an atheist. Few people really are. That means blind faith in the strange proposition that the universe originated in a cipher and aimlessly rushes nowhere. My intellectual heroes, the chemists, the astronomers, even the evolutionists, suggested vast laws and forces at work. Despite contrary indications, I had little doubt that mighty purpose and rhythm underlay all. How could be there so much precise and immutable law and no intelligence? I simply had to believe in the spirit of the universe who knew neither time nor limitation. But that was as far as I had gone. I want to stop there because I'm going to pick up from there next week. Now, so far, what Bill has talked about and what Dr. Silkworth has talked about is a twofold illness, an obsession of the mind and an allergy of the body. Now, we're going to find out, maybe next week, that it's really a threefold illness. Okay? And all the way through the doctor's opinion in the first 4 chapters of the big book, as well as the 12 and 12, it only talks about a twofold illness. A seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, mental and physical, allergy physical, obsession mental. It's when we come to chapter 5, all right, and I'm going to jump ahead, you don't need to, on chapter 5 on page 64. And let me just read what it says. It says, and it's talking about resentment, from it stems all forms of spiritual disease, for we have been not only mentally and physically ill, but we have been spiritually sick. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. So we have to remember that it's a twofold illness to a point. And that's what they're trying to, that's what Bill's trying to teach us, and the first 100 is trying to teach us, the obsession and the allergy. But what it's going to show us, once we get up there, once we get into how it works, once we get into step four, it's going to tell us that when the spiritual malady is overcome, we'll straighten out physically and mentally. And you really, I really had to get that part of the program. Before I could really get well, before I could recover, I had to get well spiritually. And that was hard for me because I had no religious upbringing. I didn't have a God of somebody else's understanding. And next week, because we're going to go faster than I have these past 2 weeks, we should be in We Agnostics by next week, where it gives me the opportunity. Bill will have the opportunity given to him shortly when he stops drinking to choose a God of my own conception. That nobody in Alcoholics Anonymous ever said, I have to believe in Buddha, Allah, Muhammad, Jesus, whoever. Nobody ever said that to me. They said, you can't do this on your own, and we can't do it for you. You've got to find a power greater than yourself. And we'll pick up with that next week. And this is an AA meeting. I almost forgot. Margaret would have hit me. So we're going to pass the basket. And if you've got a dollar, put it in. If you don't, oh, there's a basket going around right there. Thank you. So we're going to get all the way to page 60, and we're still going to only be talking about the problem and the solution. Okay, we're going to be talking about this problem and the solution, steps one and step two, all the way through the first 60 pages. At page 60, we're going to make a decision. We're going to be asked to make a decision. And then chapters 5, 6, and 7 is what we call the program of recovery. All right? So why don't we go ahead and we'll close this meeting.